feeling needs to be removed.
Nigeria has dissolved a special police unit after public protests allege brutality. And the president announced Sunday that an investigation will be launched. The scrapping of the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, or SARS, will take effect immediately, the president's office said in a tweet. The Nigerian police force announced also in a tweet that allegations would be investigated and culprits punished. The force said civil society and rights groups would be included in their investigation. Sunday's announcement comes as anger swells, both on the streets and on social media, over alleged illegal arrests, extortion, torture, and even murder carried out by members of this police unit. One recent video went viral showing the alleged killing of a man by a police officer in Delta State. The arrest of the man who shot the video sparked even more outrage. The hashtag #EndSARS has been top trending on Twitter. Ghana's President Nana Akufo-Addo arrived in Mali Sunday for an official visit after the economic group he chairs lifted sanctions placed on Bamako following an August military coup. Ghana's leader heads the 15-nation ECOWAS, which has ended its sanctions after Mali agreed to a transitional government on October 5th in the wake of the military rebellion that ousted President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. ECOWAS shuttered Mali's borders and imposed trade restrictions after Malian military officers toppled Keita on August 18th, triggering regional concern over fallout from Mali's instability. Akufo-Addo will meet with Mali's interim leaders, both colonels. Britain and Kenya said Sunday they would co-host a summit next year to raise funds for children's schooling in poorer countries, warning that the coronavirus pandemic risks depriving many millions of an education. This is VOA News. Tokyo on Sunday opened its first major community hub for LGBTQ people, part of a pre-Olympics project that campaigners hope will tackle stigma and raise awareness of discrimination. Pride House Tokyo is similar to pop-up sites at past Olympics, but will offer a permanent meeting space and information center. The goal is to educate the public about sexual diversity and offer a refuge to people feeling harassed. While Japan has some protections for sexual minorities, it remains the only G7 country that does not recognize same-sex unions, and many couples say they have trouble with things like renting apartments together or visiting partners in hospitals. The president of the International Olympic Committee said on Sunday about the new house, "In sport, we are all equal," and he wished the venture a success. Fires that ravaged parts of Syria and Lebanon in recent days have been brought under control, authorities in the two countries said Sunday. In Syria, blazes fueled by high temperatures broke out Friday in the provinces of Homs, Tartus, and Latakia, where at least three people died, according to the health ministry. Syrian Prime Minister Hussein Arnos said efforts were underway to recover from the blazes and support those who had been forced to flee their homes. In neighboring Lebanon, more than 100 forest fires that raged since Thursday were also completely under control, according to a civil defense source. Israel will oppose any U.S. sale of F-35 warplanes to Qatar, Israel's intelligence minister said on Sunday, citing a need to maintain Israeli military superiority in the region. Intelligence Minister Eli Cohen made the comments on Israeli Army Radio when asked about a Reuters report that Qatar had submitted a formal request to Washington to buy F-35 fighter jets. Asked whether Israel would oppose such a sale, Cohen said, quote, "The answer is yes. Our security and military superiority in the region are the most significant things for us. Our region has still not turned into Switzerland," end quote. The Qatari request follows an August deal between the U.S. and the United Arab Emirates in which Washington agreed to consider giving the Gulf state approval to buy F-35s and a side deal to a U.S. brokered agreement called the Abraham Accord to normalize diplomatic ties with Israel. In the United States, police used tear gas on demonstrators and arrested 28 people during a third straight night of protests over the lack of charges brought against a suburban Milwaukee police officer who fatally shot a black teen. To learn more about this story, please visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman for VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We need some punishment that will help others to not try again to do that one day, because it's unacceptable way of dealing with people, with dealing with women, or dealing with humans.
The Democratic Republic of Congo's government to launch an inquiry into allegations of sexual exploitation by international aid workers.
It would definitely be a great idea for us to have a single presidential candidate. But having a single presidential candidate by itself is not a panacea for overwhelming the administration in this country.
Uganda's main opposition party, the FDC, endorses its presidential candidate to challenge incumbent President Yoweri Museveni in next year's general election.
Same country, the foreign country, the Distant Water Fleet, and the multinational company, they take this opportunity to continue pushing and continue the IU activity, continue due to plunder the fish.
And Greenpeace is warning that multinational fishing industries are plundering the West African coastline. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the Catholic Lay Coordinating Committee says it supports an independent investigation into allegations that international workers in an anti-Ebola campaign sexually exploited local women. Hervé Diakis, a spokesperson for the group, says sexually abusing local women is unacceptable. This after the government announced plans to launch an inquiry into accusations of abuse during an anti-Ebola campaign. The inquiry announcement comes after the Thompson Reuters Foundation and the New Humanitarian uncovered the abuse. Their report cited many women describing sexual exploitation by aid workers from the World Health Organization and other leading NGOs during the Ebola outbreak. Hervé Diakis, a spokesperson for the Catholic Lay Coordinating Committee, tells me that those who committed the crime should be prosecuted to the full force of the law.
We fully agree that there must be an investigation because these kind of things are awful, and they are not only recorded about Ebola, you know, even about the UN system, it was recorded long time before. And we still have some children who are called the UN children, MONUSCO's children, because now their parents have left, but they are living with their mother without any assistance at all. So these kind of things must cease, and we support this call for investigation.
The WHO and the Organization for Migration have promised to carry their own investigation about these allegations. But some people are saying they cannot be trusted and that the government or independent bodies should do the investigation. What do you think about it?
We need an independent investigation, of course, because this kind of thing cannot happen without knowingly or unknowingly approval of those who are supposed to check about this kind of situation. If it happened now, it looks like maybe long time before it was tolerated. Now it's obvious. Then they didn't have any, nobody was sanctioned about that. So we need independent investigation in order to set up everything and to know who are responsible and in which level they are responsible.
Some people are saying the government should do more or should have a framework for these international organizations working in the DRC to prevent such future occurrences. What do you say to that?
Even the NGOs, foreign NGOs and all those things, they are taking advantage in many situations, especially in sexual situations, but not only even in what concerns the right to have a work. They are misused, they don't respect the legal time, and they are not paid as everybody will be paid in that kind of situation. Women abuse is the awful expression of that situation. There are too many other situations concerning the way people are seen when they are in dependency for working or for looking for a good salary on a job with these organizations.
Does the DRC have the legal framework to deal with the perpetrators of this crime if indeed an independent investigation establishes individuals who carried out this sexual violence against the DRC women?
There are some laws which are now in... they put some rules, but not the same way that it could be investigated in international systems. And in this kind of situation, it's better to comply our rule according international one. So why not DRC and can collaborate with an independent system in order to set up the way of investigating this kind of crime and also to improve our own system on the same level than international one?
Well, as a lawyer yourself, what do you think the punishment should be for those who carried out such act?
Okay. You know, as lawyer, I've also to respect what we call the presumption d'innocence, that people are supposed to be innocent till they are convinced in a court. But we need some, you know, some punishment that will help others to not try again to do that one day, because it's unacceptable way of dealing with people, with dealing with women, with dealing with human.
Herve Diakhisse is a spokesperson for the Catholic Lay Coordinating Committee. He spoke with me from the DRC capital, Kinshasa. Uganda's main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, has endorsed Patrick Oboi Amuriat as its presidential candidate for next year's general election. He faces a stiff challenge to defeat incumbent President Yoweri Museveni. Political analysts say the lack of a united opposition with a single presidential candidate paves the way for the president to win re-election. But Amuriat disagrees. He says he's aware of plans to rig the elections in favor of the president and his governing party, the National Resistance Movement, or the NRM. He tells me that his party has a strategy to combat any attempt to rig the polls.
My party has fielded me to run for the top job in the land with the expectation that we will win the next election and be declared and take over the reins of power in Uganda. But with that said, I must also add that we know that in our country, elections are not well managed. And therefore, it becomes necessary for us to work around that particular issue in as far as electoral malpractices and other forms of uneven electioneering playgrounds are concerned. So yes, we expect to win, be declared, and run the country for the next 5 years.
Since you have been elected, even newspapers in Uganda are saying, will Patrick Amuriat succeed where Besigye failed? What do you tell people when they bring up such issues?
I think the people are actually right to ask such questions and to shed doubt on what we are doing. And so we have got a double strategy, whereas we go into the election on the platform of using civil means to win the election. We are not oblivious of the fact that this may not happen, and therefore we have a plan that we dubbed Plan B, and this is a plan where we will keep struggling, not within the electoral platform, but by using power of the people, as is enshrined in Article 3 of the Constitution of the Republic.
So, Patrick, initially you said that elections are not particularly well managed in Uganda. How do you expect different next year?
Well, of course, one needs to understand that we are an experienced party that has gone through all sorts of electoral processes which have been unfair, largely, and that within the period we have been in those unfair elections, we have learned one lesson or two. And so we've been looking at the register very, very closely to see that it does not change so much or doesn't change at all. And in any case, if it has to change, then it has to be, that change must be legal. And so apart from that also, our people are being prepared early enough in anticipation of an unlevel playing field, but also in anticipation of outright cheating by the Electoral Commission. We definitely at this point have got the great disadvantage that this election is not going to be observed by international monitors, electoral observers, and we are going to have to rely on local observers. But we as a political party will also be putting in place vigilante observers who, although they may not be the official observers of the election, will play an active role in ensuring that electoral malpractice does not take place.
Now, Patrick, both international and local political analysts are of the opinion the lack of unity among all opposition groups, it paves way for President Museveni to win re-election because there's not a single presidential candidate that all opposition groups will rally around to defeat him. How do you address this?
I think that the analysis that is being advanced by local observers may not be exactly accurate. What I believe is that it largely depends on when the opposition wants to unite. It would definitely be a great idea for us to have a single presidential candidate, but having a single presidential candidate by itself is not a panacea for overwhelming the administration in this country. It is possible that multiple candidates uniting at a certain point after elections, depending on how we fare, would make more sense.
Patrick Oboy Amuriat is the presidential candidate for the Ugandan Main Opposition Party Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. A former advisor to the Libyan National Transitional Council says experts and rights activists appear to have lost confidence in the United Nations support mission to Libya, or UNMSIL, to the North African country. Omar Turbi, also an international relations expert, says the UN agency in the country should make an effort to win the trust of Libyans. He underscored the need for transparency and a credible electoral and public deliberative process to help stabilize the country. To learn more about proposals by Libyan experts to help stabilize politics in the country, I reach Omar Turbi.
You know, Libya experts and rights activists put the UN a notice. The reason we are doing that and continue possibly to have a dialogue with the UN, the processes that have produced governors in Libya have failed to produce the right government. Services have gone bad. Militias have not given up nearly 20 million pieces of weapons, and the economy is in shambles. The infrastructure is terrible, and it caused the army from the east to make a move and go forward to Tripoli early 2019. And we're here in wrangling and having the United Nations trying to institute or conduct a process identical to the one that took place in 2015.
Some are saying that the warning is misplaced because Libyans are the one at loggerheads. Libyans are not keeping their country safe. Libyans should be at the forefront in rebuilding their country, blaming the United Nations is neither here nor there. How do you respond to such an assertion?
Totally true, even though Libya does have many brilliant people and people that are capable of running the affairs of Libya, but are not given the opportunity to do that. And that is one of the very, very reasons we are pushing very hard for two particular processes to take place to complement what the United Nations of support in Libya that are have to do with proper nominations, meaning draw from other members of the Libyan society to help produce a very competent government and make nominations public. And also the second component to what we are pushing with the United Nations is a period or a phase whereby you look into the background of the candidates, put them before a public hearing televised so that you can actually vet their skills and vet them out and make sure you have the right people.
What specific steps do you think the UN mission in Libya can take at the moment that you think will help in Libya's process to rebuild the country?
That's a very good question. The UN mission in Libya should have an observation role, not an executive role to impose either individuals or impose a government. If you help Libyans conduct their own affairs and produce a government in the right manner that we are proposing, we are likely to have a competent government. What we are recommending basically is whatever dysfunctional body that is in Libya now, that is the House of Representatives, we go back to that House of Representatives and pick or help the Libyan people assemble a maximum of 39 members of that House of Representatives that represent the cross-section of Libya, but allow each region to nominate the persons that would be running the country, from the presidential council to the prime minister to the ministers, and produce candidates and nominate more than one person for each region, and then have the body of 39 plus a committee that we are highly recommending, which we call the Competence Committee.
Some Libyans I spoke with are saying that some of you Libyan experts in the diaspora overseas are just there and issuing out press releases without coming to the ground. And that some of these suggestions that you are throwing about are just a figment of your imagination and are not practical enough to resolve the current issues on the ground. Briefly, what is your reaction to that?
I totally agree with you. First of all, not every Libyan that has left Libya and gone outside Libya to study or live in Europe or the United States has earned or has become capable enough to serve the Libyan people. I totally agree with you. What you said, they're outside and finding all kinds of stuff and don't know what's happening underground. You're absolutely correct. That does not apply to me. I'm constantly inside Libya. I've helped Libya in so many different ways, and that's a known fact.
Omar Turbi is an international relations expert and a former advisor to the Libyan National Transitional Council. He spoke with me from California here in the U.S. A U.S.-based environmental organization is warning that multinational fishing industries are plundering the West African coastline. Its latest report looks at West African governments, including Senegal, Mauritania, and the Gambia. It says while they are administering emergency food distributions to local communities due to the coronavirus pandemic, they are also enabling what the organization described as the systematic plunder of the oceans by foreign fishing vessels. Greenpeace is calling on the government to shut down fish meal and fish oil factories. It also wants greater transparency in the fishing licensing process that will ultimately help the artisanal sector. Ibrahim Asise is a senior oceans campaign manager for Greenpeace Africa. He tells me that there is need for the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, a regional bloc, to adopt a sustainable strategic plan of fisheries which focuses on the dwindling of the pelagic fish stocks.
This report is highlighting what happened during the COVID time. And of course, the fish meal, fish oil factories are established this last 10 years. They have increased just from around 10 in the wool region. We are now more than 50 factories. So those factories are competing with artisanal fishermen and women processors because they are targeting the small pelagic. They turn it to fish oil and fish meal to export it to Europe and Asia. The oil for cosmetic and pharmaceutic and as ingredient because it's very rich in omega-3. And the fish meal to be used to for aquaculture, but also for livestock to feed pigs and cats, etc. So all this is done while the communities, the population, the actors don't have enough food or enough fish for themselves.
Why do you think these governments in West Africa have been unable to prevent this from happening?
Because for some country, there was some lack in the regulation because West Africa is very rich. So they constantly have a lot of requests from this company to come to open this kind of factories. So they are going opening factories. In Mauritania, there's a lot of them. In Senegal also, they have started to open. But people start also to demonstrate, to say no, they are not hungry, particularly the women processor because they are the first impacted because they have less access to resources because the fish meal are paying more money. And we have highlighted this issue and we are campaigning for that. And we still highlight, we still continue campaigning. We have the case of Kayar where they want to build a new factory. The capacity of this new factory, if it starts working, it means that the whole community of Kayar don't have access to fish.
Based on your data, Greenpeace is demanding the shutdown permanently of some of these factories. Some people are saying that they are employing and you are taking food away from their families. How do you respond to that?
The fish meal factory don't take a lot of employment. It's one factory can take 5%. If you take the artisanal fisherman or the artisanal processor, you have a whole chain. You have the woman processor. You have behind the retailers. You have the people that are selling the same product in the big market. You have the consumer. So you have a whole chain. So the impact is 40 times more important than the industrial. I'm not talking even about the fish meal because the fish meal is one is polluting the environment. It's not creating job and is using the fish that should go to feed people. You need 4 to 5 kilo of fresh fish to make 1 kilo of fish meal. And you need around until 20 kilo to have a marketable size of fish or of salmon or tilapia, let's say. Right now, the tendency shows that West Africa is the region where the consumption of fish is going down, is declining. So they are importing fish right now. So how can we import fish in West Africa? In the meantime, we allow the fish meal factories and the big vessels, the IU vessels, to continue plundering the stock. In the same time, the FAO highlighting that the stock is no more exportable.
Do you think the government in the region are too weak to address this? And what role do you think members of ECOWAS can play in the case of possibly adopting a sustainable regional management plan of fisheries?
West Africa is the only region where you don't have regional body that manage the share stock. Anywhere else you have it. We have sub-regional fishery commission, but they don't want to give this commission a mandate to manage the resource, even the share resource, because they are creating competition between states, you know, because they are trying to move bilateral agreements. If you move bilateral agreement from Mauritania to Senegal to even Sahara, Morocco, until Sierra Leone, all foreign countries, include European Union, Asian country, all of them, China, all of them, they are trying to have bilateral agreement. But they know when they have bilateral agreement in one country, in the same time, they are targeting a resource that is shared between countries. But as countries are not ready to sit together
to have consensus on the share stock to fight against the IUU fishing together, and to at least to manage the resources together, and to face the same issue, same country, the foreign country, the Distant Water Fleet, and the multinational companies. They seize this opportunity to continue pushing and continue the IUU activity, continue to plunder the fish.
Ibrahim Asise is a senior oceans campaign manager for Greenpeace Africa. He spoke with me from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. But first, Zimbabwe, like the most parts of the continent, is reopening its economy after COVID-19 lockdowns. As commuter traffic comes back to life, the government is working to create a monopoly, and a government-owned company is now the only operator able to offer public transportation services. For VOA, Kutsai's Vanavashi has more from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Privately owned public transport operators have been idled since Zimbabwe began COVID-19 lockdowns in March. Those bus operators willing to resume business have been told to put their vehicles under the government-owned Zimbabwe United Passenger Company. Michael Ndebele is an entrepreneur, and he says the move by government has its shortcomings.
The idea of banning private operators, it's ill-informed. We have seen serious challenges with transporting labor from point A to point B. That is in terms of the working hours. People are not able to come to work on time. They are not able to go back home on time.
Ndebele owns several small companies, including a transportation business. He says his biggest worry is that his employees can't get to work on time and home again after work. He adds that the government is sending mixed signals in its efforts to open up the economy.
What we have seen is an intention to open up the economy, but that intention is not supported by a vibrant and an operational transport sector in Zimbabwe.
Tafadzwa Goliati is the president of the Passengers Association of Zimbabwe. He says transportation wars have left the commuting public desperate, and many taking risks by hiring private drivers.
We don't have enough public transport countrywide. People are hiking in private cars. What we encourage people to do is to consider their safety. Passengers are being robbed at night when they board private vehicles. It's a serious challenge to us. We don't know what to do about the challenges, but we've actually presented this to the government.
Goliath says, with schools and businesses now opening, there are not enough buses to service the public. The new policy covers commuter omnibuses and regular buses, which are required to join the state transportation company if they want to resume operations. Taxis are not included in the policy, and they remain idle under the coronavirus restrictions. Ndebele says there is need for government to be consistent with policy in order to boost confidence in the recovering economy, which was already affected by lockdowns. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zvinavashe from Harare.
Seven activists who booked Airbnb accommodation in one of South Africa's most upmarket seaside suburbs have complied with a court order to leave the house. They booked and paid for 3 nights, then informed the managing agent that they will not leave and call for land justice for members of the LGBTQ community and other vulnerable groups. In response, the management company obtained an eviction order. For VOA, Vicky Stark spoke to the activists at the property in Camps Bay, Cape Town, a few days ago.
That's the sound of the final protest song and dance taking place inside the Airbnb holiday house a few minutes before the clock strikes 12, When it does, it will mark the court-ordered deadline for the seven to vacate the multi-story house with its views of the Atlantic Ocean. One of the occupiers, Letabo Hanong, who identifies as transgender, got involved because of homelessness and needing a decent space to live.
I've been threatened living in the township. I've been raped. They even inside me that I'm a disgrace. I should be beaten up so I can be a normal male or normal boy.
While South Africa grants full legal protections to those who identify as sexual minorities, many who do say they still face discrimination, violence, and deprivation in their communities. That includes being blocked from safe housing in a country that suffers a shortage of housing. The High Court heard the eviction case on October 2nd. While it granted the eviction order, the court also ordered the City of Cape Town to provide alternative accommodation for the occupiers who had nowhere to live. But occupier Sarah Summers says the land on offer was basically a shack.
Alternative housing that they've offered is inadequate. It's not okay to be like on this vacant piece of land far away, particularly if queer individuals are vulnerable because of their sexual identities. We need safe space. We need space that disrupts the spatial injustices of apartheid that haven't been adequately changed since 94.
When asked what they say to those who ask why they felt entitled to take someone else's property, occupier Kelly Eve Kwipman replies.
I think the word entitled is very interesting because I think it's interesting that people who don't live in the country and have many assets and many properties and many businesses feel entitled to own and profit off empty homes in prime land areas in the midst of a national disaster, in a housing and land crisis. We live in a system where people have historically procured property in such unlawful, violent ways and can continue that legacy because of the protection of privilege under the law.
She says they decided to comply with the court order because if they didn't, the judge said they would have to pay all the costs of the court case.
In terms of this eviction order now, I think that's as far as it went for the seven of us for this house, for this particular case. I think what's happening is at the moment is that there are other movements who are seen to be interested in a similar action, perhaps interested in this house, perhaps others. That is out of our control.
The online rental service Airbnb put out only a short statement saying while they deeply respect the freedom of expression and rights of those who protest, their platform requires that it honor the trust that property owners put in them and in the guests in their private spaces. It said for that reason it supported the host in this matter. City of Cape Town Councillor Roberto Quinta says while he sympathizes with the cause, the rule of law must apply to all South Africans.
I personally spoke to the policy director for Airbnb Africa to thank us for their pledge of support and calling this illegal occupation out for what I believe for what it was. So this is done to highlight the dire need of both the LGBTQI community and housing in general. However, it was done with extreme detrimental negative and damages to a barely only starting to recover tourism industry in Cape Town, on which most of Cape Town is so heavily reliant. So it was quite a selfish act. There are better ways to highlight these very real causes.
The seven occupiers say they'll be taking a break before announcing their next move. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
The UN Refugee Agency says it is racing to help tens of thousands of Congolese forced to flee a recent upsurge of fighting and atrocities in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo's North Kivu and Ituri provinces. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
More than two-thirds of the DR Congo's 5.5 million internally displaced people are generated by armed conflict in North Kivu and Ituri provinces. The latest surge of fighting, which has dislocated more than 50,000 people, is compounding the misery of a displaced population that is the largest in Africa. The UN Refugee Agency reports brutal attacks in North Kivu, many blamed on the armed group Allied Democratic Forces, have displaced a huge number of children, including many who are unaccompanied. UNHCR spokeswoman Shabia Mantu says civilians are caught up in a vicious cycle of violence and displacement, with many forced to flee for the second time this year. She says fighting in Pinga, an area in North Kivu, has reached an alarming alarming stage. She adds a UN interagency mission that went to the area in August received reports of human rights violations, including killings, rape, kidnappings, and use of child soldiers.
Over 270 children associated with armed groups were identified, and allegations of child recruitment, killings and mutilation of children, and sexual violence against children were also documented. At least 54 children who were recently released by one armed group were then apparently forced to join an opposing faction in the area.
Mantou says similar scenes of brutality are occurring in Ituri province. In the southern territory of Irumu, she says there's been a sharp increase in violence with the emergence of a new armed group. At the same time, she notes there's been an intensification of attacks by other armed groups and militia in the region.
These groups all apply the same destructive methods of looting and burning houses to the ground, which makes it difficult for the displaced to return to their villages. Since July this year, more than 120,000 people have been displaced by the surge of violence in the Southern Territory. Armed groups have continued their attacks in September, killing at least 43 people and kidnapping 17 more in the territory.
Mantou says the displaced are having a hard time meeting their basic needs. She says shelter is scarce and many are forced to sleep out in the open. She says the UNHCR, partners, and local authorities are providing shelter, health care, water and sanitation, and protection. She notes the aid is crucial, but much more is needed and will be needed for a long time to come. Unfortunately, she says, the relief operation is at risk because of lack of funds. She says only 61% of this year's $168 million appeal for refugee and IDP aid in DRC has been met, and the year is quickly drawing to a close. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Uganda's Joshua Cheptegei broke the men's 10,000 meters world record, as Ethiopia's Letsene Bet Gide broke that of the women's 5,000 meters in Valencia. The 24-year-old Cheptegei clocked 26 minutes, 11 seconds, to beat Kenenisha Bekele's 15-year-old time by more than 6 seconds. 22-year-old Gidem clocked 14 minutes, 6.62 seconds, to better the time set by Tirunesh Dibaba in 2008. This was at the NN Valencia World Record Day, a one-off event in the Spanish city. Bekele's previous world record time had been the longest-standing men's 10,000 meters world record in history. Cheptegei's success marks his fourth world record in 10 months, having broken the 10-kilometer road best in December and the 5-kilometer road record in February. He also broke another of Bekele's world record at the Monaco Diamond League in August, beating his 16-year-old mark in the 5,000 meters by 2 seconds. Later in the week, Sifan Hassan set a new European record for the women's 10,000 meters, beating Paula Radcliffe's 2002 mark by more than 24 seconds in the Netherlands. The 27-year-old Dutch woman, who won 1,500 meters and 10,000 meters gold at the World Championships in Doha last year, clocked 29 minutes, 36.67 seconds, Only seven other women have been below the 30-minute mark, and Hassan becomes the first European to do so. In another development, next year's Tokyo Marathon has been rescheduled from March 7th to October 17th because of continuing concerns around the coronavirus crisis. Around 38,000 runners are set to take part in the race, but restricted entry into Japan and rules around big events has seen the race pushed back. The pandemic forced the 2020 Tokyo Olympics to be postponed by a year. The games are now set to start on July 23rd, 2021. In football, the lifetime ban of former Ghana Football Association president Kwesi Nyantachi has been reduced to 15 years after an appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. A former FIFA council member and vice president of the Confederation of African Football, Nyantachi was banned for life by FIFA in October 2018 for breaking bribery and corruption rules. Meanwhile, CAF has released the detailed fixtures for the 2020 Championships of African Nations CHAN tournament. This tournament was originally set for April 2020, but was pushed to January 2021 due to COVID-19 pandemic. The tournament will kick off on January 16th, 2021. Host Cameroon will take on Zimbabwe before Mali takes on Burkina Faso in Yaounde on the opening day. Four venues will be used for the championships that will run up to February 7th, 2021. CHAN is a tournament exclusively played by locally based players. Its inaugural edition was in 2009 and was hosted by Ivory Coast. Morocco are the reigning champions. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Baby, I put my feature on you, baby. You know I'm your only lady.
CBO, nishapitia mingi mikasa paka kukutana na wewe. Sina budi ni tulie. Niache kuchapa lapa, nigandane na wewe. Unatuliza tukio Unanifumbaza Kemtoto mdogo Sina budi kusifia We mtoto moto
Baby I love you
Baby, I'm a G la kwako, I'm a lady. Pende ni kupende paka tuje tudate. Ni kupendele paka ni kupeka, baby. Oh yeah, of everybody you the realest. Love the way you handle me when I'm in my feelings. Don't know why they talk a lot about the dealers. We can make love, but we also handle business. Siki fumba macho na kuona wewe. Me love you long time, and you better every day like you fine wine. Every time I see your face, you are so fine. Thank God I am yours and you all mine. Ah.
Maliza vyote mama, adi nisivyo vijua. Nichanganye changanye, nione mapicha picha. Tufike wote tena, tamu nyongo sije kutia. Moyo wangu kapata pata shika. Waokope wapashikuna, awachelewi kwa ribu mambo. Yakawa sio, hey. Tusichoke tu. Vubua, wakilenga ola Usije ukanyumbua nikikosa hela kijora Najua unajua na kupenda sana
Baby I love you
Sugar boy, give them the run, you know, and we leave for the you myself, but say, lady tonight, are you sure you can take this love? DJ jam this song, all my people sing along. We will live for the party, for nobody. We live for the party, oh Lord have mercy. We live for the party, no remorse and no mercy. We live for the party, oh Lord have mercy. Hola, hola, with fucking bars. We making noise. Hola, hola, I hear the bubbles. Hola, 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 select. Oh, they made my bubble.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are there on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when you climb the mountain and reach the top, do not forget the branches and the shrubs that helped your footing. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.